We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Your favorite source for Chicago White Sox talk, delivering news, interviews, analysis, and more. This is the Sox Machine Podcast with your hosts, Jim Margulis, James Fegan, and Josh Nelson.
Thanks, Rob, and welcome to the Sox Machine Podcast. I'm your host, Josh Nelson, and it's Monday, February 19th, 2024. Happy President's Day, especially for those that have bank holidays off in your corporate world. We at Sox Machine are still hard at work as the White Sox continue to prep for spring training games. And now the position players should be reporting to Glendale, Arizona, and we'll learn more about the White Sox goals to improve their woeful offense a season ago. But on the pitching side, there are big questions surrounding Michael Kopech and Garrett Crochet. The latter wants to be a starting pitcher and is introducing a new pitch that we'll talk about in a moment. The former, and Kopech, is trying to rediscover his best self and find a way to make that version the norm. We've seen Kopech dominate, especially last year against Kansas City and Cleveland, but great starts are the outliers in Kopech's starting career. Helping both is the new director of pitching for the Chicago White Sox, Brian Bannister. We'll learn later in the show how he's helping Kopech, Crochet, and other White Sox pitchers. Oh, and there's another update regarding the South Loop project for the Chicago White Sox. We now know how much Jerry Reinsdorf is asking for. Lots to discuss, so let's get started. Joining me is our beat reporter down in Arizona, James Fegan, and the managing editor of SoxMachine.com. It's Jim Margulis, and hello, James and Jim. Jim, I'll start with you first. We have some exciting news as Sox Machine just hit a milestone.
Yes, we reached 1,000 Patreon supporters early on Sunday morning, and they've continued to trickle in. So we are currently at 1,008 when I'm looking at this. Hopefully when people are listening to it in the morning, afternoon, that number will continue to rise higher. But yeah, that's one big one because it's nice, four figures, nice round number that everybody kind of measures by, typical milestone. But also just it was one of those figures we had in mind in terms of like, need to get there before the season starts to have a real good feeling about where this is going. And we're ahead of schedule in that regard, so that's cool. Still have many milestones to hit to make sure that we can do a living, make sure that we can send James out on the road more. But early on, looking at all the people who responded to James's tweet informing people he's laid off from The Athletic saying, oh, I'll subscribe to you wherever you go. And I have not had to harass those people in their mentions, say, where are you? I know your name. I don't see you here. be a man or woman of your word. I don't have to do that anymore. So far so good. And, hopefully as the stories continue to roll out from James, and then like once we get him on the road too, like I think there'll be a few different entry points as far as people checking in the season, and hopefully we'll continue to prove our value every one of those steps along the way.
Well, I guess the good news is, James, is that we don't have to go and hire Liam Neeson, maybe get a cameo from Liam Neeson. We could just have Jim do it, because that was pretty intimidating.
I mean, Liam Neeson would only push up the subscriber total we have to hit even more, so lead to an escalating chain of violence, I feel.
Could we get Liam Hendricks?
I think Liam's still soliciting offers at this point.
All right.
I thought I thought he was going to announce where he was going to be playing. But if he didn't make that announcement, he's still a free agent. And as we record, he's still a free agent, so we'll see him what his plans are. There's always the option that when he is healthier, that he could throw, have a, I guess, an audition for teams during the season. Yeah. And then he can get signed in July or August and help out a team before the postseason. He's still getting $1.5 million from the White Sox over the next 10 seasons.
It's also possible he could have like a normal recovery timeline and just not pitch this season. Because like,
very true.
Davis Martin's probably like on a 14-month track. Like Liam doesn't have to beat every estimate by 4 months for everything every time.
Yeah, his body has gone through a lot, especially the last couple of years. Moving over to the White Sox side, the White Sox have a record 70 players right now in spring training camp. And James, I should just ask the simple question. Why? Why are the White Sox carrying so many players at camp?
I mean, I guess because they're trying to... I've never seen actually the movie Battle Royale as much as I've heard about it, but it's kind of like you don't have this set bullpen. You don't have this set roster that you've had the last couple of years. It makes sense. They have these like a really long slate of projects and they talk about them pretty earnestly. At least Bannister did, that they're trying to just basically see making a bunch of plays with a lot of their non-roster contracts and seeing if they can make these guys pop in a way that, you know, maybe some characteristic of their stuff or maybe some past success indicates that they could be restored to at some point. Upside surprises is a term that he uses. And I think they're just in the lack of, you know, actual budget room or even maybe will to commit to a free agent, given where they're at in their cycle. It's like, let's just take a series of tryouts, like just buy a bunch of scratch off tickets and see what hits. And that's really probably going to be, even as much as Jim broke down, you know, on Sunday, how many guys like have opt outs or out of options or other reasons why there's a little bit of pressure to make a call on them. They really don't have a lot tying their hands as far as commitments. I think if you know, let Davy Garcia hit waivers because he didn't have a good spring, I think you're probably willing to call the experiment off at that point. So I think they're in that position with a lot of guys, and you know, talking to a lot of like relievers who are NRIs, talking to Joe Barlow today, is like, why did you come here? It's like, they said I have an open opportunity to make the roster, so that seemed like a good shot for me. Whereas maybe other guys, it's kind of more cut and dry that they'd have to, you know, dominate AAA for a month or two to really get a midseason call up. No one here has any reason to not think that the open day slot could be theirs if they show out. So I think that drew in a lot of people, maybe people who might be on their way out of the majors otherwise, or certainly if this doesn't work out, like if Mike Moustakas can't break camp with the White Sox, I don't know what the next thing is for Mike Moustakas, but I feel like we have a lot of guys in that same spot.
Taiwan.
Yeah, Taiwan, South Korea, the Savannah Bananas. He's got options if he doesn't make the White Sox. Ted Mulvey, if you're listening to this podcast episode, I do not need this sporacle. All right? We don't need name all 70 players that showed up to the 2024 spring training camp. Like, I don't want to get embarrassed because, like, my goal would be, can I get 60%, Jim, of them correct? It's so many players at camp, and one of them that has just showed up was an old friend, but now is a current friend, Brian Shaw. Is one of those recent non-roster invitees. And you wrote on SoxMachine.com over the weekend why you think he has a track of making the team. And even with that opt-out stipulation, I think it could be valuable to have a rubber arm reliever like Brian Shaw for the 2024 season. Do you agree with that sentiment, Jim?
Yeah, as long as he's the same guy and like he didn't happen to resemble that kind of form that he had the last 2 months because he had a 4 month tune-up essentially in the minor leagues and a whole lot of runway to get right. Because even in July, when he first arrived at the White Sox and they still had all of the relievers they'd yet to trade, like he was pretty lousy in July. And he was lucky probably that he endured that long. The All-Star break probably helped as well to kind of spare him a little bit. But it wasn't until everybody was traded and they were down to the dregs that anybody who could respectably and reliably retire hitters on a regular basis would be given lots and lots of opportunities. And he certainly ran with that. So it would stand to reason that he would get that same opportunity again. Grifol liked managing him because he really didn't have to give him any consideration whatsoever, especially like at the end of the season, five games in a row to end the year and five hitless innings to end the year for Shaw. So there's a lot of just familiarity and simplicity there if he's the same guy. And if it's not a case of just like he got, you know, he's in his mid 30s now, around the, you know, closer to 40 than 30. And he's got like he needs a lot of time and a lot of, you know, runway in order to get right. I think that's my one reservation about him. But yeah, it's based on what he showed last year, what everybody has yet to show for the White Sox or in the majors recently among his competitors, I would pencil him for a spot. Like, it's just more a matter of, you know, is he healthy? But, you know, he certainly proves he's healthy. He's never been given his, you know, how many times he's led the leagues in games. He's never unhealthy and he's always willing to pitch. Just more a matter of like, after another year, is his stuff still there? And so far, like, I would assume it would be more so than all the other fringe relievers or maybe quadruple A guys on the way out that he's competing with.
Yeah. To Jim's point, Brian Shaw led the league in games appeared in 2014, 2016, 2017, and 2021. 81 games he appeared in for the Cleveland Guardians in 2021, half the season. Last year, 38 games for Brian Shaw. Like, that number snuck up on me. I know it was a lot of Brian Shaw in the second half. But James, I didn't know that he finished 17 of the 38 games that he appeared in. I don't think he's getting a close to 50% ratio of his appearances where he's finishing the game in 2024, right? Like, he's not plan A to replace Gregory Santos as the closer.
I would think if things, crack right. First of all, I've been just mystified looking at Brian Shaw's draft, because he's the same draft as Buster Posey and Gordon Beckham and Brett Laurie.
Wow.
But I think if you're trying to look at like kind of the other invites that they have, or maybe the other candidates, I would think maybe an ideal scenario or the most rosy thing you can think of is like, well, you've got Corey Knebel in camp. That's a guy who's, if healthy, his ceiling actually involves later inning work or high leverage work with, you know, playoff teams. You know, he's been an all-star closer in the past. That would probably be something where you think like, that's somebody who maybe takes over a high leverage role if he's healthy and things click right. I think Dominic Leone's probably a tick under that, but that's certainly someone who probably has more recent experience working a lot of high leverage than Brian Shaw. Barlow would be, you know, as much as he's kind of got a vulnerable fastball that he tries to pitch around, and that's going to be a high wire act. You know, he's certainly someone who thinks he's been working on with Bannister as far as his timing and kind of shifting his hands and, you know, not losing some tension in his delivery, that he thinks if he really perfects it could add another mile or two back to his fastball that he lost over the last year or two. I think you probably have some guys with a little bit more high leverage experience that you would hope would pop, whereas Brian Shaw is kind of this, what's the name of that tape that the guy slaps on the tank of water that you put on?
Flex Seal.
He's almost like, right.
I saw it a boat in half.
He's someone that if they were like, if this was like a team with like any designs on contention at all, I'd kind of almost worry that like Shaw is almost too user friendly for a manager that someone with a lot more credentials than Pedro Grifol, Terry Francona, like drove his fans nuts with how much he used Shaw, even past the point of maybe the effectiveness of the prime of his career. So I think if he was really in a good situation, you'd almost worry that, you know, overusing Shaw as much as like, that's always an option. And you're always negotiating guys being up and down during the season. And he's such like an easy fix to it. I don't know. I mean, it's unreasonable to project any 36-year-old to be effective on 80-game, 1-game usage, but this is just a season where, you know, throwing Brian Shaw to the thresher in favor of like someone else is a reasonable solution, because, you know, the worst thing that can happen is that you lose as many games as we all think you're going to lose. And that's not, you know, the worst punishment this year.
Yeah, that's kind of how I foresee Shaw used. A lot of games where the White Sox are down by 4 going to the 7th inning. Here you go, Brian. Get us to the 9th. Save the bullpen. And that's useful, especially with a lot of young arms that the White Sox have and with the veterans that they have in the non-roster invitees. We assume we'll start the season on the opening day White Sox. We'll see how close I don't know, 70 games Brian Shaw gets to in 2024, but he's going to be used a lot by Pedro Grifol. Now, let's move over to some great work over the weekend, James, especially when you got a chance to meet the new director of pitching for the Chicago White Sox, Brian Bannister, and what he's aiming to fix with certain White Sox pitchers. Are you now imagining hula hoops around White Sox pitchers while watching their bullpens at camp?
Trying to. I think if I was really good at that, I might, you know, have gotten the job in player development. But here I am at Sox Machine instead. it's just something I feel like has it certainly clicked with at least, I guess, the Connect selection of kind of down and out desperate men that is the like connective theme of the White Sox, where it's guys who feel like they've been out of sorts for reasons they can't put their finger on, and having this guy say like, let's embrace your natural arm slot and see what happens, or let's look at video and see where your arm was at and where your path was when you were really clicking, and let's do that. Because a lot of times it's, or at least a lot of things we talked about specifically, was guys kind of trying to accomplish something specific and that leading them away from just how their delivery should operate normally. So the one I wrote about was Kopech, but another one we talked about specifically was Chris Flexen, just because it's kind of so easy to visualize. Chris Flexen is like a really like shot put type, or not shot, but like axe throwing. Josh Colemeter for the Diamondbacks is who I think of. Like, he's got this really high arm slot and release. So what Bannister was saying was that the Mariners went kind of sweeper crazy last year, and they're kind of having everyone implement to see what would work. And by trying to do that, Flexen started going a little bit more to the side to try to get the side of the ball. And you know, for some reason, some guys were, you know, regular three quarters or low three quarters, that came a lot more easily for them, but that didn't really click with Flexen. And it also kind of got him a little bit off his plane for, you know, how a lot of his other arsenal works. So it's, sounds simple enough to try to just get a guy back up there, but that seemed to be the crux of what he was saying, was where they think, like, that's what identified him as somebody like, this guy was decent-ish and not decent in 2021, solid contributor, and had success in the KBO, kind of like Eric Fetty. Both Eric Fetty and Chris Flexen were being swarmed by South Korean media on Sunday, which is like the minor league version of what's going on in Dodgers camp is my Japanese media. But that was kind of an easy way of why they identified Flexen as like, hey, if we got him back to his natural path, maybe this is a guy who becomes like a, you know, back end mid rotation starter again, like he was in 2021. So if you imagine like 25 more guys like that, that kind of gives you a view of what Bannister's work is. So Ethan Katz is expected back in camp this week. You know, his mother passed, and condolences to him and their family. But what Bannister emphasized is that he probably would have been this active. You know, he's in every bullpen just chattering away, giving suggestions, even if Ethan were here, because like, this is his time to shine, where everyone's built up and, you know, been throwing all offseason. They're ready to kind of see how stuff works that he suggests, but games haven't started yet. And they're not like, you know, I'm not trusting this new thing if it's going to get me hammered, or they try the new thing he gives them and they go out and they get hammered and they never try it again. They're kind of removed from that little situation. So this is his time to strike with a lot of such projects. And, Flexen, Kopech, those are examples of that. But, you know, I think he's got some others. He's probably showing Mike Soroka, Michael, don't make that mistake, a lot of stuff that he did back in, you know, 2021 or before he, you know, tore his Achilles, however many times it wound up being.
Yeah, so that was going to be my follow-up question. This idea of plane of rotation that Brian Bannister was referring to when he was speaking with you, that's going to be different for every pitcher, right? Like,
yes,
aiming for your natural throwing motion, it's not going to be a uniform throwing style. Like, there are some, it's opening weekend for college baseball, and I heard a lot about pitching labs from some of the top schools. Like, it seems like there's one idea, let's all try to be uniform with our throwing mechanics because we know that this method works, this helps you max out your velocity. It seems like Bannister is zagging, where, listen, if that doesn't work for you, well, it doesn't work for you. Let's just find what did work for you and try to be more natural about it. So, okay. So that, because that was going to be a follow-up to you, because if it's going to be different for every pitcher, that's going to be interesting watching this team throughout the season, right, James? Just to figure out if these guys could find what works for them naturally.
Yeah, because I think especially like maybe when I first started doing this, like everybody was talking about four-seam ride. And so it was a lot of coaches and players looking at videos of like who does the best four-seam ride, and they get up here and backspin it. So I need to get up there too. And maybe even if I take my axis a little bit to have to get up there, like, so be it. I want this like efficient thing.
Right.
And, you know, maybe some guys have the athleticism to kind of contort themselves and pull it off. But for a lot, like repeating and commanding when you're not on your, like your natural, you know, axis or arm path, it's a challenge for a lot of guys. So, you know, someone like Michael Kopech, who's running the trouble, who's been trying to throw like this perfect four seam fastball, maybe that's part of the equation for him. At least what Banister thought is that he was a little too resistant to rotating to the side at the end of his delivery. He was really encouraging him to finish, you know, let his arm go across his body the way it's kind of wanting to every time, and not be so obsessed with like, oh, I have to be on top of the ball. I can't get the side of it at all. So Banister was saying that, you know, he was citing his experience with the Red Sox when they were playing the Rays, is that they would come out and see a bunch of guys with different arm angles, and it felt like right as they were about to time somebody up or kind of get on plane with what they're facing, it would change. So out of a really diverse staff where everyone's throwing different angles, you know, if you remember that, like, I think that graphic they used to have where all the Rays arms angles were different hands on the clock, that's like his, you know, ideal, platonic ideal of what the pen would be. Now, you can't just necessarily say that they've acquired all those guys and you don't want to contort guys to make them to fit that. But the idea is that everybody's going to be so diverse or different based on just, you know, respecting what their individual path was and maximizing it, that you're going to, you know, have more diversity than if you just say like, I want all riding four seamers through the entire staff. That one has become so commonplace that it's really more about what you can do that's unique and give hitters a different look than maybe, you know, doing this perfect execution of this one thing that became popular. But also, you know, it's something that a lot of hitters are just geared to swing at now, where you're seeing the low slot guys have a lot more success just because it's unusual.
And that kind of reminds me that the White Sox now have one of the Rays minor league pitching coaches now at AAA in Charlotte, R.C. Lichtenstein, if that's how you pronounce it, if it's the same as the country, if it's different. But yeah, I mean, so
I really hope that's how it's.
Yeah, it'd be great. It sounds like a fake name that he came up with while looking a map of Europe and drinking a soda. Just, what's your name? R.C. Lichtenstein. Yeah, and then all his paperwork had to follow that exact choice he made. But, you know, just seeing him come to the system, it kind of makes some sense in terms of if some of these guys have to go down to Charlotte and work on it, that if you have a pitching coach who's used to working with guys who throw at different arm angles and slots and different hand positions, then perhaps, you know, it's not a case of like trying to maintain everything you learned in Arizona without having to, like, you know, having Brian Banister be four Brian Banisters and be everywhere. Maybe it's somebody who's just more used to like being able to see a guy who's throwing slightly lower than another guy and say like, ah, that's fine. That doesn't throw me off.
Another element that Banister brought up is that, you know, the Sox are a little bit in a position where beggars can't be choosers. They can't be like, we only want this certain type of guy. They kind of need to be able to take all comers because they don't have like this reputation as like fixers of pitchers. They kind of have to take on whatever reclamation project they can and not really have these barriers or entry like, oh, we only specialize in four-seam ride, or we're only a sinker baller team. So as much as like some players have said, like, I feel like they're embracing a lot of guys who are sinker sweepers, I don't think that they're really trying to lock into having a specific type. The age of everybody out of the White Sox is going to be throwing cutters, seems to have gone past at long last.
I just find this topic fascinating, Jim, because now when we watch Michael Kopech during spring training, it's almost paying attention more on how he's throwing versus what the actual results are. And we know that most of the time we get throughout spring training results. We've talked about it over the years. Breaking pitches just don't work down in Arizona for XYZ reason. We're more focused on how does the velocity look as pitchers get closer to opening day. If Banister could get Kopech's fastball back on track, which that was a plus pitch in 2021 and 2022, not a plus pitch last year. Not only did James point out in his article at SoxMachine.com that Kopech have a hard time commanding that pitch, opposing hitters had a 462 slugging percentage against Michael Kopech and that four-seam fastball. So if it was in the zone, it got hit pretty hard. If that fastball comes back to his 2021 self, Jim, is that enough to convince you that, yeah, Michael Kopech should start the season as a starting pitcher?
Yeah, I mean, like, when it comes to, like, that big question of starting or leaving based on how few starters they have or how many guys will have to be expected to pick up starts along the way, that if he stretched out, used to it, has a record of being effective or at least not getting killed when he's off his game. You know, he has some ugly lines, some really short outings, you know, 80 pitches over three innings, but he doesn't tend to cave in and get destroyed the way other guys can. So for now, that's an advantage. The hope is, you know, maybe by the, you know, second half of the season, there are more guys challenging for starting roles, and so starts aren't necessarily a given, but I think that you have to work with what you have at any given point, and that's what the White Sox have right now. So I would think, like, yeah, as long as, you know, he's in the zone, he's able to hit different spots in the zone with his fastball and slider, then I think, like, you know, there's a chance of him sticking beyond we need him to start. And, you know, the point that James relayed from Bannister about, like, how he missed so often with his fastballs and other pitches, mostly fastballs, like, up in arm side. Yeah, I looked on MLB film room and just, like, sure enough, there's, like, a two-sequence or two-batter sequence against the Tigers where he walked two guys in eight straight pitches, and all the fastballs are basically either up or up and away. And so you could just see him stopping the arm and, you know, not swinging all the way around, not following through the pitch. And, like, oh, yeah, that's very easy to see. Reminds me of, like, Dylan Cease, who had the opposite problem of just, like, spinning away too much, you know, throwing a lot of fastballs in the left-handed batter's box. And, you know, that was a problem that he had to work. And he still has to work occasionally to, you know, minimize the amount that he does that. But the next time he came around in spring training, like, oh, he's hitting more spots in the zone. And even though his, like, curveball and slider weren't what they were, and we didn't know what the slider exactly would become, you could at least see with his fastball, able to hit, you know, down and in, able to hit up and away. Like, he was spotting it in different locations. He hadn't done it before. So I think with Kopech, it's going to be a similar exercise of watch where the catcher's setting up. Does he get the ball there? Or does he get the ball in different spots when he misses? Is he missing in a different way, or are all his misses the same? I think that'll be what I'm going to be looking at. And also probably just to see, like, you know, how often he does that quick recoil of just, like, bringing the arm immediately back to where he doesn't finish the pitch.
We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences, so the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Yeah, no, really good points. And I'm glad you mentioned Dylan Cease, Jim, because as I was reading the article and we're having this discussion, like, Cease came to mind with Bannister, like this invisible hula hoop. Is there something to that with the mechanics and the way that Cease throws that can get him to stop pulling that fastball so much into the left-hander's batter's box and get him to where he's obviously aiming is that, like, top corner? So he could get the opposing hitters to focus on that area and then just crush him with that devastating slider. Obviously, that's the goal, but he had a hard time getting ahead of hitters last year. Now I'm going to be watching Cease, Jim, with this invisible hula hoop and seeing if he could stay within his hula hoop.
I feel like, you know, we talked about it before, I think, in different ways, but this is a case of, like, talking about invisible hula hoops. Like, this would be a great time for, like, some, what do you call them, psychotropics to sponsor the podcast. Start seeing things that you didn't see before.
Yes. If you sell those items, hit me up. we'll be happy to add you to the show. All right, so let's move on from invisible hula hoops and let's talk about this new pitch shapes that Garrett Crochet is working on as he's trying to learn to become a major league starter. And one, I did like how he admitted that what everybody did last year for the White Sox and preparing for 2023, they're doing the opposite. If you slim down, they're bulking up. If you bulked up, they're slimming down. And Crochet told you that he lost about 20 pounds to get ready for this season. How does Crochet feel about where he is physically coming into 2024?
He said, I feel like Crochet's, off the record, like clubhouse chatter is like almost as informative as anything else. The harmless thing I overheard him saying was he's about to throw with Kopech and he's like, arm's feeling froggy today. And I just felt like that's probably not something he thought a lot during rehab. But the whole idea was Garrett Crochet. I mean, he still is because he's so big and his head shaved and he's always wearing like sleeveless shirts. But last year, Garrett Crochet just utterly terrifying human, just the colossus of scale that I've never seen before. And I've covered NBA games now and it still sticks out. He was very built. He was very huge. And like, I get it. Like you're doing rehab. You're trying to like find a purpose during Tommy John rehab. You know, he just worked out. He just added strength. He figured if I add strength, that's like, you know, coming off a major injury, that's something he wants to have, especially if he's like going to be routed towards the bullpen. And he's like, you know, I'll have more power. I'll have more strength in my legs. He was big on adding strength in his legs and bulk in his lower half. Which was visible through the uniform when he got back on the mound in several ways. But the idea was like he had more strength in his legs, going to take stress off his arm, was, you know, the general concept he's going around. But he didn't feel like he was able to really get into, you know, the same delivery positions when they put him through biomechanical analysis as like ideal points in his delivery. He felt it was harder to get into it. So the idea is that now he's lighter, he's going to be more fluid, especially as a starter, maybe less thinking about like one-time explosive movements and more like having, you know, the body that you feel like you can move in the same way and repeat your delivery, you know, over the course of, you know, dare I say, six innings at some point, a Garrett Crochet outing, lasting that outing. I don't know if such a thing has occurred since 2019, but that'd be the dream at some point for it to occur. So I think he's feeling pretty good. He's pretty healthy. What he's not doing is promising triple digits because he basically said like, the year I did that, I was just building forever. I was just throwing in the backfield, just trying to build velocity, build strength, and not ever competing in games. So he doesn't feel like that's going to be something he's going to be able to replicate, especially if you stretch him out and put him in the starter role over the course of 6 months, that he's going to be able to reach the same peaks that he reached in his draft year. It would be really nice if he did that. You know, the extra 3 miles of velocity really, really kind of adds something to the picture because it's not a fastball that you hear scouts saying has like a super unique approach angle or like this really like definitive movement. It's just hard from the left side. Now, hard from the left side can do a lot. It's still going to be like a big pitch for him. I don't think it's like a vulnerable fastball that he needs to hide, but it's part of the reason why it's not just going to be like, you know, I know he didn't have any walks his rookie year, but it was very much like the Liam Hendricks version of not having walks, where, well, behind in the count, time to challenge him down the pipe. And I don't think he necessarily has that heater anymore. And he really describes his slider more and more as kind of a sweeper. So it's really something that it's maybe not that kind of, you know, firm bullet spin slider that, you throw to get on the hands of right-handers in maybe the more typical way. So that's why he's adding a new cutter. And since he's still kind of mastering the changeup, you know, like most power pitchers are perennially trying to develop their changeup, he felt it was something that, you know, a little bit better or a little bit more suited to kind of getting inside a right-handed hitters, grabbing strikes and getting ahead and not putting all the work on getting ahead in the count or, you know, challenging people in the zone on his heater, but, you know, something that could give him something else. Now, from hearing him chatter when he's walking off his live bullpen today, I know he threw a bad one to Adam Hackenberg that got taken deep. I don't think a one spring training home run in inner squad or in live BP means he's going to abandon the pitch, but it also speaks to it being something in development. But it seems like something that you would add if you're trying to, you know, make a starter's arsenal where you can steal some pitches and then be more efficient, and maybe not something that you would, you know, focus on if you're a reliever and everything's about wiping guys out and, you know, pitching in traffic a lot and, you know, keeping, reducing contact as much as possible, the way you was pitching the last several years.
Yeah, because in your article, he talks about his slider being more of a slow sweeper. So he's hoping that the cutter is like a good happy medium between the fastball and his slider, especially against righties. And Jim, when I read that Crochet added a cutter, my initial thought was Coop will fix him. Mm-hmm. what are your thoughts about Crochet adding a cutter to his arsenal?
Well, I thought you're going to segue to that earlier when we talked about like how the days of Don Cooper teaching everybody a cutter are over. And then like, speaking of cutters, here's a guy where a cutter is going to solve everything. Garrett Crochet. But we ended up going on a psychotropic tangent.
Well, we got to talk about Crochet's wagon. Yes. I mean, that's a very popular topic on White Sox Twitter. He often gets compared to Adam Engel, who evidently also had a big wagon, as the cool kids would say. And it sounds like he lost 20 pounds. So, James, you could confirm the wagon is not as large as last year.
It's reduced, I would say, yeah. Okay. Or maybe he's wearing, like, you know, more...
Well, they did change the pants.
He still does the little roll-up thing on his cuffs that, like, obscures how tight his pants are a little bit. I think it's reduced. I think he's, you know, back towards, like, maybe Tommy Canley levels or a little bit below that. But not, you know, peak 2023 Crochet, I would say.
Yeah, I saw him in Birmingham and I thought, like, is that Kevlar? Is he keeping state secrets in there that needs like protected? Because in person, like, especially like sitting behind home plate, it's like, man, you know, you can see it from the front of him. It's weird, but...
So often they stick water bottles in there. You just assume that's what's in there and then there's no water.
Yeah. But...
So the cutter.
Yeah, the cutter. Yeah, that's what we're talking about before we got distracted. Yeah, the cutter, like, it's hard to know with Crochet, like, how much of this is kind of serious and how much of this is humoring the experiment, because it does seem, and James alluded to this with Pedro Grifol's comments about, like, they're going to need a lot of guys to soak up multiple innings because of various restrictions. Pitchers have various talent levels. Pitchers have, although he didn't really use, you know, that specific word, but he said like there are going to be a lot of opportunities for extended relief. And so even if Crochet doesn't stick as a starter immediately, they might not have to send him to AAA or AA, depending on what kind of environment they want him to work in, to, you know, stretch out and get used to everything. And it seems like long relief would be a happy medium. So if he goes to like the 2-3 inning plan, then he doesn't really need that cutter. That is really just more like, you know, I think providing a different look if he's having to face a guy a second time. So, you know, until we see what the plans are, it seems like, you know, it seems theoretical or like on paper, yes, it makes sense to add a cutter, add a strike throwing pitch if you are a fastball sweeper and you don't like your changeup that much, need something against righties, especially if you face them 2 or 3 times in a game. Sure, you know, point is granted. But if this is going to be like they want to satisfy his competitive instinct to show he can start and he wants to see if his body responds better to longer outings rather than just, you know, quick usage every other game, and they figure like, yeah, you know, we'll let you pursue that and build up for it. In the meantime, we're going to have this plan A for us, plan B for you, and we'll see if we can make it work in a compromise. And so like the cutter just might be something where like, yeah, you kind of have to work on it if you're going to be starting and you need to do that now. But if it is like, if the Adam Hackenbergs of the league are teeing off on it, then you could see like a case where, you know, there are only a couple more points to where like, yep, long relief, you know, like high leverage bridge work might be the role for you.
I went back to like the well a little bit when we were talking to Grifol today about Crochet and be like, so with all these guys you have stretched out, you'll need some like multi-inning relievers, right? And he's like, yeah, that would be a really useful role for us to have. And then I don't know if he like figured out what he's doing or thought he's going too far, but he's like, but we're not there yet in determining who's going to go in that role. So I was like, you notice I asked that right after Crochet. So I still feel like that settling point is in play for him.
Leading the witness.
My follow-up then to that point, Jim, is if Crochet is working out right now at camp, getting himself prepared for this experiment to be a starting pitcher, admitting that he's not working like the way that he did to get drafted by the White Sox in the 2020 MLB draft to impress everyone that he could hit 100 miles an hour, that ultimately, if he's still a reliever and he doesn't have that type of velocity, is he going to be effective as a reliever? Or is he just still stuck in between these two roles, and what the White Sox have on hand in 2024 is still a below league average pitcher, no matter what the role that they put him in?
Well, I think he's shown enough to where, like, yeah, he fits well in any bullpen. He might not be saving games for any bullpen or just any bullpen. It'd have to be a series of circumstances. But if you can set aside the control loss or command loss that he had coming back from Tommy John surgery, and that'll come back to him, it's just a matter of getting fully back to where he was, then he should be fine. It's just not, you know, it kind of goes back to the Kenny Williams pick of Royce Ring and using a first round pick for a reliever. Yeah, everybody realized that was a mistake when it happened, or, like, you know, basically like maybe a few months after it happened. And then you, a decade later or so, then you go back to drafting another reliever only. Different circumstances with the pandemic, with the White Sox making a push, with like a whole lot of guys not being sure how they're going to bounce back or when minor league baseball will come back, college baseball, etc., to where, like, they, I think they were chasing a median outcome, which is like, if you have a reliever who spends 10 years in the majors, that's probably a median outcome for a first round pick, or at least, like, you know, first half of the first round. So, like, I get the thought process, but it would be underwhelming. But I'm not too worried about, like, Crochet, his stuff not working. I think it's more a matter of, like, can he actually stay healthy? Because it's been, he hasn't proven that yet in any role, whether starting or leaving, to where, like, will his body respond to the rigors of pitching over the course of a 6-month season? And so far the answer has been, like, it's been tough. And, you know, hopefully, you know, because he had to seem like he had to stave off Tommy John surgery once after the Oakland series in 2020, and eventually has succumbed to it. Like, maybe this is behind him, and maybe it'll be a little bit smoother sailing for the next year or two to get him on track to be, like, one full-time job, whether it is starting or relieving. And I think we're all leaning relieving.
Yeah, Crochet is not, he's not alone in that camp of, can my body hold up for a full regular season? There's unfortunately many White Sox players on this roster that are in that wagon, along with Garrett Crochet, a different type of wagon. James Crochet, is he expecting an innings limit in 2024?
He kind of thinks, like, yeah, that could happen. He doesn't have one that is hanging over his head. He was kind of talking about, like, he just wants to force the issue. You know, he acknowledges that it could be in place. I think basically as an industry, we've moved away from innings limits to, like, there are a lot more metrics that are on place to be like, hey, this guy is falling off a cliff. You know, it could just be velocity, but you could see, like, extension or you know, spin X, like, arm angle dropping. There, I think there are ways to probably monitor his fatigue that go beyond just, like, saying, you know, at 120 we shut everything down. At the same time, would it be shocking if he went over 120? Yeah, probably. All of this is pretty surprising to me because I didn't think you could launch a starting transition off of 10 innings the way you had last season. But I think it's a bit more like they're going to have to blow past any reasonable limit that you would put based on projecting what he did just to extend him out at all. So I think it's going to be a lot of, he's expecting it just, like, it's going to be monitoring me and me telling the training staff how I'm feeling, and that's how it goes from there. And if there's a season where you can skip a guy in the rotation or shut a guy down for 10 days, or, you know, do whatever you need to get him through without worrying about, like, the team needs him right now, this is probably that sort of season.
Well, again, it's been great work from you, James, and Jim as well, adding the additional analysis about Michael Kopech and Garrett Crochet. Definitely worth keeping an eye on, but also getting some insight from the new guy, Brian Bannister, in hopes of helping the White Sox pitchers get back on track. And if the defense is good, then we could really focus on just how many fewer runs the White Sox allow in 2024, and ultimately that should help with their win total going into the season. The last thing that we'll touch on in this podcast episode, and I'll put this out there now, we are expecting more information coming later this week. There is an Illinois Sports Facility Authority meeting at Guarantee Rate Field at 10 a.m. Wednesday, February 21st. There's on the docket right now on the agenda quite a bit discussion about the current stadium for the White Sox. Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker will be delivering his State of the State address at 12 p.m. Central Time on Wednesday. And there's a Chicago City Council meeting also on Wednesday. So when the story broke Friday night, Jim, from Crane Chicago, and Justin Lawrence from Cranes wrote that story, and we'll be doing a podcast with him later this coming week. So even with these new details, there's probably going to be more to the story. But Jim, $1 billion. That is what Jerry Reinsdorf is asking for. And according to this story from Cranes, he is confident that he can get $1 billion based on his plan from the state of Illinois. And I went down this rabbit hole when you wrote about this on SoxMachine.com, comparing it to what the Chicago Cubs and the Ricketts family had to go through. And it was before I moved to Chicago. So a lot of out-of-town stupid. And then I also didn't know Chicago politics very well. In that Ricketts family asked for $200 million in 2010, didn't get that. 3 years later, they had to get permission from the city of Chicago to invest $500 million of their own money. But then again, they had to get permission because they were building a hotel. They were taking out that old McDonald's across Wrigley Field. They wanted to add 10 more night games. They wanted to add the scoreboard because they were butting heads with the rooftop owners. Like, there was a lot of hurdles that the Ricketts family had to jump through just to renovate Wrigley Field, even though they were willing to spend their own money, $500 million, more than a decade ago. They had to get permission from the city. And now here's Jerry Reinsdorf in 2024, and his grand plan is, I bet I could get $1 billion for the state of Illinois for this project. How likely do you think this will happen based on your vast knowledge of Illinois politics and more importantly, the vast knowledge of what happened last time Jerry Reinsdorf approached Illinois for a new stadium?
A lot has changed since the last time, 1980s, with the whole, you know, the threat to relocate the team, which was very real, with St. Petersburg having a dome that was ready for baseball, just needed a team, whereas like that's not looming over everything. So this does seem really excessive. And not only to ask for $1 billion as a starting point, but to say like, you know, or at least have the story say you're confident about $1 billion. Just not even saying like, oh, let's throw this out there as a starting point. If I get $400 million, I'll be happy, but I only get $400 million if I set a really high bar and then it looks like a compromise where I'm giving up something. $1 billion is like a huge ask. And it really seems like, you know, you need a lack of shame, which Reinsdorf, you know, he possesses. Like, he just doesn't care what other people think. He's pretty sealed off from public opinion in that regard. So asking $1 billion of public money is probably something that does not keep him awake at night. So there's that element to it of just like, he'll do it and he won't feel bad about it. I think where I don't know, or I get hung up, is like with the Bears factoring into it, and the Bears maybe providing that opening to where like, yeah, well, you know, the financing of this will allow the city of Chicago to avoid some really onerous balloon payments on the debt that Soldier Field has accrued. And, you know, that bails them out of that. Is that just kicking the can down the road? Is that something like Pritzker is fine with? Because like that becomes like the next mayor's problem or the next governor's problem if it gets up to that level. Just like if the bill for that becomes due 20 years from now, nobody who's currently holding position will be around to see it. So that's a problem for tomorrow guy.
Right.
That's the element where I don't quite know. And maybe that's the opening because Reinsdorf is pretty good at this when it comes to getting public money or not, you know, investing any of his own money into big projects that he benefits from. Like, it's hard to, you have to give him the benefit of the doubt that he might be able to pull something off. I just think it takes balls because like, given that he's never paid $100 million for a free agent or even like, you know, extending, he's never committed $100 million to a player, and he's, you know, the White Sox are one of two teams has never done that. And, you know, he scoffs at signing, you know, Shohei Ohtani or Gerrit Cole or anything like that. And then just to go like, yeah, $1 billion. Gimme. And not seeing any kind of cognitive dissonance with the reason why people aren't happy with him. There's never going to be the satisfying realization or epiphany that, oh, this is what it's like to be a fan of my team. I see the error of my ways. It's just going to be like, no, gimme. And then we'll see if that gimme comes true.
Yeah. The reason I want to do a podcast episode with Justin, because there's this part in the story of Cranes, as Jim mentioned, with Soldier Field. And I would love to see the James Fegan eighth grade project on how close you were to your estimate of how bad this deal is for Chicago and Illinois, James, because in 2003, the state authorized the ISFA to issue a $399 million bond to pay for the renovation of Soldier Field. 20 years later, there's $384 million in principal. In 20 years, the ISFA has only paid off $15 million on the principal. And right now, the projected cost of Soldier Field is $55 million, and that is set to raise to $90 million in 2033. And what I want to ask Justin about, because these numbers that Related Midwest keeps bringing up, Jim, and you wrote about this too, like all this revenue this project is going to raise. In 2019, Chicago hotel tax revenue was $55.8 million. 4 years later, despite having that NASCAR race downtown, despite COVID restrictions lifting, $41.2 million, a $14.5 million difference from 2019 to 2023 suggests to me that Chicago is still recovering from COVID. Like, we're not back to where we were pre-2020 as a city. So if we're still not back to where we were pre-2020, I don't know about these estimates that Related Midwest is bringing up. But like, to Jim's point, James, it's kind of hard for White Sox fans that live in the city and the state. Like, if you flat out refuse to make long-term investments in players to better the team, why should White Sox fans and taxpayers do the same for you on a new stadium?
I don't know. I don't know how you justify, as a society, prioritizing private sports teams the way that we do. Clearly, we have an irrational passion for it as a society. Otherwise, I wouldn't be out here tailing a likely last place baseball team with daily coverage and, you know, taking the money of devoted subscribers to talk to Jordan Leisure at 9 a.m. But
quiet, James, you're ruining it.
And you wouldn't want to see my Chicago Metro History Fair presentation, because it did not have enough colors, which is why it got an 86 score instead of 98-99 from all the other teachers, and kept me out of from going to the next round. But I think, you know, I don't want to say Jerry's like a shrewd businessman, but like, I feel like he's going to explore what he can get away with. He's going to see, you know, how big of a deal how good of a deal he can get. And I think he's been pushing the envelope on stuff like this and using kind of aggressive tactics to get the last stadium. And it's not surprising that he would kind of go to the mat and see what the limit of what he can push for this. I think before the price tag came, there was probably a lot of excitement about the renderings of the stadium, and that, you know, a refurbished ballpark would probably get a lot of momentum and a lot of enthusiasm around the team, you know, even without results. I'd probably be a lot easier if they were coming off of four straight playoff appearances to be like, well, this is a team that's bought a lot of goodwill and we wanted them to stay, so maybe this is a pill they have to swallow. But especially as much as people will say online, like, go to Nashville, we don't need this, I think it'd probably be a lot of be very heart-wrenching to see them move in any way. Or I think testing the pressure of how much resolve there is to keep them in town is something that's paid dividends for him in the past. And I don't see why he wouldn't go back to that well, at least in initial steps like this, to see the limits of it. And, you know, if he says he's confident, and that's, you know, coming from him, you know, he's had enough success in this realm that I can't dismiss it. I don't think I'm going to be sit here and say like, there's no way he gets that money, because he's gotten stuff like this in the past, and a lot of owners across the league have got stuff like this in the past. Maybe not to the scale, but it wouldn't shock me.
Yeah, I'm curious on how these meetings go. Pritzker's definitely going to be asked about this. We'll see if Brandon Johnson, the mayor of Chicago, is asked about this. If he does meet with the media after the city council meeting on Wednesday. So the next time we have a podcast together, us three, we're going to learn more about the government side on what this proposal is from the Chicago White Sox and related Midwest to the state of Illinois. And if Illinois says no, because even if finances are getting better on the state level, they just don't have $1 billion to hand over, or they just don't have the appetite to extend taxes or increase the amount that the ISFA can borrow. I'm wondering how the White Sox pivot. Like, that's the question I leave for podcast listeners and for us to contemplate. Does Jerry Reinsdorf have $1 billion in liquid? Like, does he have the ability to self-finance this like the Ricketts family was able to do around Wrigley Field? And I don't know the answer to that question. So if Illinois says no, and it's a hard no, we can't help you on that front, we'll do whatever else we can, but we can't give you $1 billion. Is this project dead, Jim? Like, that's the lingering question that I have. And when I record with Justin, that's going to be a question I posed to him. Like, is there a plan B? Like, we definitely know this is plan A for the White Sox, is to move to the South Loop.
I don't think there's a plan B yet. The way the idea was rolled up, I'm related Midwest, standing in front of everything, being the ones that were holding the meetings, giving the quotes, issuing the renderings, made it seem like the White Sox were going along for the ride. So this might have like popped up on them earlier than they thought. I know they're exploring it, and that's why they floated the idea of Nashville and you moving out to the suburbs and various, you know, kind of possible sites, explorations, ideas. But if related Midwest, like, oh, you're exploring, I got something for you. And the White Sox are like, sure. We still have a perfectly fine ballpark, and we still have a lease that runs for another 6 years, and we could probably extend it if need be, because it's in the state's interest to keep using the ballpark for baseball rather than build something new. Like, it's a good situation to be in. So they have time on their side. So, yeah, what I would be interested in seeing is, like, if this kind of blows up, or, you know, something else more cost effective takes its place, do then the White Sox start using this to threaten, or maybe, like, you know, kind of insinuate more about, like, looking elsewhere? I could see, you know, given how little Reinsdorf cares about, like, public sentiment, is more about just getting the most favorable deal for him and his investors. You know, I'm inclined to say, like, oh, you might see the elbow sharpen a little bit about getting his way. But I think right now there's probably a case of, like, related Midwest and the White Sox see a window to maybe horn in on some public funds before the Bears can get to them. And so maybe this is why they're doing it now. And then if this doesn't work out, then they'll continue on the original plan of just exploring sites and ideas.
I will give related Midwest and the White Sox a little credit here. I like their chances a lot more than the Chicago Bears getting public funding for a new stadium. Man, so much money out on Soldier Field. And we'll see on the updates again. We'll have another podcast episode talking about this particular topic, especially the TIF funds and related Midwest. Really interesting. Some of that money is going to be used to build a new CTA red line stop on this land. So really opens up the other possibilities as far as transportation to the stadium. I know that's been a pretty popular topic as well. And we'll hear again from the politicians, and maybe we'll even hear from the ISFA as well on Wednesday about their thoughts regarding this proposal.
Do you think, like, they could make a successful ad campaign, like, around me? Like, if they show video of me, like, freezing when the Sox were clinching the playoff spot in 2020 because the wind was blowing the press box, they put, like, that Sarah McLachlan song over it, and they're like, don't you think he'd be much happier here? And then they show the renderings of the ballpark on the riverside.
If you're cold, he's cold.
Yeah, that's, I was just going to frame that.
The coffee machine's, like, broken again.
Let him in.
Well, again, when we get more news, we'll report it on SoxMachine.com. We'll also talk about it on the podcast. But that will do it for this episode of the Sox Machine Podcast. Thank you guys so much for listening to this episode. You can follow us on social media. We're on all the platforms at Sox Machine. You can follow James on Twitter if you're not already, as he continues to provide updates of what's happening at camp for the White Sox at JR Fegan. And you can follow me on those platforms at SoxMachine_Josh. You can subscribe to the Sox Machine Podcast wherever you listen to podcasts, such as Spotify and Apple Music. And also subscribe to our YouTube channel at YouTube.com socksmachine. There'll be some videos up there. I watched a lot of college baseball over the weekend, so I'll post those highlights on our YouTube channel in the upcoming days. As Jim mentioned at the beginning part of the show, if you want full access to all of our coverage of the Chicago White Sox, sign up at patreon.com/socksmachine. Monthly plans start at $5, and there are additional tiers as well with additional perks. Our $25 month tier, they're going to be having a chance on Monday to join a Zoom meeting and be able to have informal conversation with James about what's going down in spring training for the Chicago White Sox. And we still have some spots open in our Veterans Committee as well. We have about 6 spots open. So if you enjoy our work and you want full access, you can get that for just $5 a month. But if you want more from us, there are those options as well. Check them out at patreon.com/socksmachine. The Sox Machine Podcast is a production of SoxMachine.com. You're on for all things Chicago White Sox baseball and part of the Blue Wire Podcast Network. Alongside James Fegan and Jim Margulis, I'm Josh Nelson. Thanks for listening and watching.